Yes. Yeah.
Mm. Do you want to take a look at it? Or?
No.
Okay. Sure.
Unfortunately, my French is so bad.
We don't French.
I read some of it. I can't remember half of what I remember, what I learned.
Great. Shuhaki, that's the name of the translator. Right, exactly. Yeah, since we started talking about it, let me take it back for a second. This is the translation that I've mentioned a few times by Andrei Shuhaki, and if Charlie comes, I'll let him read a few scriptures from it. But here, for example, is one comment on the back, saying that this is a unique translation because this is the first, basically, Jewish Jew to publish an integral French translation of the New Testament. So, in other words, the first one that's actually from a Jewish perspective, and it's made from Jewish Greek, as opposed to a translation made from Christian Greek or even Koine Greek.
What is a Jewish Jew?
Well, that's another discussion. It actually says in French, Judaisant, so a Judaizing Jew. In other words, one who's remained faithful to Judaism as opposed to going to some other religion. Anyways, this is class 5 of Copernicus and the Jews, dealing with chapter 5, office directory. Let me just start again with a quotation. This one is from Luke chapter 22. And there arose also a dispute among them as to which one of them was to be regarded as greatest. And he said to them, "The kings of the Goyim lord it over them, and those who have authority over them are called benefactors. But it is not this way with you, but the one who is the greatest among you must become like the youngest, and the leader like the servant. For who is greater, the one who reclines at the table, or the one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at the table? But I am among you as the one who serves." And here's another, one of the two other descriptions of that incident from Matthew 20. "But Yeshua called them to himself and said, 'You know that the rulers of the Goyim lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many.'" Now, I've devoted a fair amount of my life to studying human societies in different ways. And I'm sure some of you have also, in history, in political science, in sociology. And one thing that I think is incontrovertible in observing human societies is this statement that Yeshua made, which is that the people on top lord it over the people who are not on top. And Yeshua is describing this as the way of the world, and it certainly is. Regardless of the ideology of the government, regardless of which part of the world the government exists in, and so forth. And it's interesting, he then says to his Talmidim, his students, "You are not like this, or you should not be like this. We're going to have the opposite rule. If you want to be great, you must make yourself a servant. If you want to be the first, you must act as the last, as the youngest, and give yourself up to serve others." Now, thank God for congregations where this idea of servant leadership is understood. Unfortunately, when it's not understood, it can be a really horrendous experience that is rather far from the Bible, I would say. So we can be grateful when we encounter places that do have an understanding of this. Certainly, throughout the history of, let's say, people who sought to follow the words of Yeshua, or at least claimed to want to follow the words of Yeshua, this passage is not one that has been well observed. And in fact, throughout the history of Christianity, of course, it is mostly a history of inventing different titles, like benefactor or something else, and then proceeding to lord it over other people on the basis of those positions. Today we're going to look at part of that story, not the historical part, maybe not even the human part in the sense of human attitudes that produce that type of behavior, psychological part, if you will. But we'll look at some of the linguistic component of those historical realities. The subtitle of the chapter is Transliteration Creates the Illusion of Christian Religious Offices. And I think one thing that this chapter shows is the extent to which that simple choice to transliterate instead of to translate did create an entirely different world with all sorts of different titles and positions in this new realm. So that's what we'll be discussing today. First, as always, I'd like to ask for a review of last time. So is there anyone who was here last time who would like to briefly summarize what we discussed, just so we can get ourselves back in the flow?
There's no such thing as church.
Okay.
At least not in the Messianic writings.
Just put forth that it was an intentional slant of the original Greek, that is to say, to put it into a Jewish or, quote, Christian context.
Okay.
That historically, the purposes by which this was created was to establish a direct connection between the state and the kingdom of God, so that those who directed or had power in the state could claim to be the objectification of God on earth.
Yes.
That they could basically validate their power,
mm-hmm.
and validate their positions.
Right.
By claiming to represent God on earth.
Okay. Anyone else maybe on the translation
issue? I was going to say, linguistically, kahal and edda are translated ecclesia and synagogue, and they mean gathering, congregation, meeting. It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And then how are these same words translated in the text of the Messianic writings, at least in Christian translations?
Synagogue was translated synagogue where it was in a bad light, and ecclesia, even though ecclesia was more a translation of kahal, or when it was in a good light, because ecclesia represented a non-Jewish entity. But one thing that's interesting to note is that in meaning gathering, neither word had a religious significance until it was translated.
Yes, and I would say synagogue was translated as synagogue when it had a bad or a Jewish meaning.
Yeah, that's
and ecclesia was translated church when it had a good or a Christian meaning. What about the last section of the chapter on chazon or revelation? How did that influence our reading of an important passage there?
There was a twist
in the old.
It was written so that the people who worshipped Satan or whatnot, the synagogue of Satan.
But some of the ones who call themselves Jews but aren't Jews. And in the church, it's always been considered those who were ethnic Jews who thought saw themselves as Jews, but they really were not the people of God.
Exactly.
And yeah. The thing here, that this is really more Gentiles who consider themselves Jews, like the replacement theologists.
Right. And the reason that it was usually commented on that way in Christian theology or Christian tradition was because of this phrase, the synagogue of Satan.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see from the linguistic discussion that we had that really it should just be translated as some sort of neutral term, a congregation of the adversary, not implying that these are Jewish people. And then it goes on after that to say people who claim to be Jews, though they are not. So it seems to be emphasizing that these are not Jews. And we talked about how this phrase was used in Christian history to justify persecution of Jewish people as a whole, to identify Israel as being the synagogue of Satan.
I found that in a book that I am reading, and it was kind of a surprise. It was like, oh, that's true. We are just discussing about it. We are just discussing about how people translate that terms, like the synagogue of Jews, you know? And this person was just making or emphasizing that is in the New Testament. You know what I mean? I was like, oh, that was a wrong translation. You know, everything is making sense for me right now.
It's also interesting to note that That translation of that word from the Septuagint, even in the Tanakh, was often translated as church when it served a replacement theology perspective. There is, for example, the translation that you'll often see that says the church in the wilderness.
Right, but that's a quote that's from actually the Messianic, from the New Testament, let's say, referring back.
But it's
to
referring back.
But it's not translated that way in Tanakh itself.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But it's referring back to it as that's what it represented.
Right.
And again, the perspective there, as a matter of fact, Berkhof bases his entire systematic theology on that single portion of a verse.
Very interesting.
To replace Israel with the quote-unquote church. Yeah.
So single words can be very important.
Yeah, that single word is the foundation of an entire 26-volume book of systematic theology.
Wow.
I just have a question, and this might be just about that chapter from last week. That is that the chapter is saying there's no church in the Bible, and it goes and looks at the language of ecclesia. That doesn't mean church, doesn't mean religious, doesn't mean Christian, mm-hmm. congregation. Uh-huh. It seems to me that somebody could come up and just with a different argument and say, okay, the word church is not in the Bible. But they could argue that the meaning that they assign to the word church is in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they would do that, I mean, after reading this chapter, they wouldn't do it through Ecclesia, they would do it maybe through Body of Messiah, as meaning what they think of as church, which would be believers in Yeshua. At that point, I mean, certainly you'd have to change the language that's referring to Ecclesia as church, but what do you think would be the answer? And I couldn't figure it out why.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Does anyone want to take a shot at answering that question?
I'm not sure I heard a question.
About Body of Messiah, that's a phrase elsewhere in the Messianic writings. And
that's what we mean when we say church. That's what the church could say.
Yeah,
unfortunately, it has negative connotations with Jewish people, if you're talking about that way, and it separates. It makes it, what we're trying to say is that this is, God's doing the same thing, okay? And people who insist on it becoming a church are saying, no, this is separate from the Jewish people. This is separate from, you know what I'm saying? And that's why, I mean, Body of Messiah, I don't have a problem with that. That's, you know, but the church has always been something that's separate. You know, the thing, the synagogue was over there, the church was over here. And so it's not. It's always supposed to be the same thing together.
Okay, there are a couple other people who want to take a shot at answering this, but let me just clarify the question for those who didn't hear it. It's basically this. Okay, maybe the word church isn't in the Bible, but what I mean when I say church is in the Bible. That's basically the question.
Well, there's three problems with that. Problem number one is, like Humpty Dumpty said, words mean what I say they mean. What do they mean by that?
Right.
And historically and contemporaneously, it means precisely what we hold it to mean, and that is a separate organization, a separate new thing that was created to replace, okay, all of what God had promised to Israel. Okay, that is what it means. You can choose to call it anything you want. You can call it papaya if you want. Okay, but if it still means what we're talking about, and it does mean that, you cannot separate it from the reality. You can say, well, when I say church, what I really mean is this. Well, that's fine if that's what you really mean, but that's not what it means in contemporary society. That's not what it means in the Gentile world. It means exactly what the Gentile, quote-unquote, church says it means, okay, which is a new creation which has replaced, okay, Israel in God's economy, and something that has separate promises
and a separate reality and something totally unique and separated from Israel and all the promises that God has made. The second problem with that is that why do you have to assign a meaning to something other than what the plain meaning of the text is? Okay? The scriptures and messianic writing tell you precisely what the body of Messiah is. Okay? And it is all those who have faith in him. Okay? Why do you have to assign a meaning to it? Okay? It's there. The meaning is there. It's in the scriptures. Okay? You don't have to assign something different. You don't have to call it something. Okay? To make it real. All you have to do is read the scriptures in their plain normative sense, except when it makes no sense to do so. Okay? Then you do have to maybe assign something else. And, you know, like faith is like a mustard seed, not talking about agriculture. Okay? Then the third problem you have with that is that whenever you assign a new category of things to the scriptures, okay, what you're essentially doing is ordering the scriptures according to some artificial device. You're establishing over the scripture, okay, a way of organizing God's words that are suitable to you, that allows you to create essentially your own meaning, okay? And I have a problem with that in general. That's what systematic theology is all about, by the way. People have written books that are literally take up an entire bookshelf to try and explain a single chapter, okay, of the Tanakh, okay, and because of systematic theology. And what ends up happening there is that what God intended to easily communicate his truth to all mankind becomes what? The province of only very, very, very highly trained, extremely well-educated experts. Okay? Then you end up with the office directory. Okay? That's what you end up with, the office directory.
Not to follow up Peter's comments at all with what I'd say, but there feels like there's a bit of a heaviness with regard to blaming people who try to interpret the Bible. I'm not speaking to Peter at all, necessarily, at all. You know, just to
you
say,
can talk to me, that's fine.
He didn't go anywhere.
I to a degree that it was all this dark, intentional distortion of meaning. I think it was more misunderstanding and doing the best they could. And in some cases, perhaps, you know, those there were people inclined to torque it, tweak it in a given direction, but it feels like there's this overtone of it was a Christian intention.
Well, I would take exception to that as it regards people like Origen and people like Augustine and people like Charlemagne and people like King James, because they did overtly and purposely intend to distort the meaning of the Word of God to serve their unique parochial means, their unique parochial, what's the word I'm looking for?
Agendas.
Mm-hmm. And they stated it plainly so.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all in the first chapters of this book, amongst others. And this book is quoting them. It's not superimposing upon them, you know, this person's opinion. They've made these statements categorically, and they made these statements openly, without restraint. So I agree with you to a significant... I mean, for example, I'll give you a specific example where I agree with you. Okay? John D. MacArthur. Okay? When he came out and attacked Messianic congregations, I don't believe that he had an evil intent or an agenda. Okay? Now, it turns out that years later, he sort of backed off from that. Okay, but I think he did it with good intent, okay, with the intent of preserving the message of Messiah to the Jewish people, okay? But, you know, Charlemagne, King James, Origen, Augustine, Chrysostom, and the other Antinicene fathers, I think it was very purposeful. And they said so.
Maybe a handful of people.
Yeah, but that's where all this comes from.
But it does just feel like this overarching umbrella of blame upon all of Christianity.
Okay.
Well, impactful people, though. It's not like these are just run-of-the-mill clerks. I mean, Augustine was an emperor who made Christianity the religion of the government religion. So
part of the premise of the book up to this point has been misunderstanding, misinterpretation.
Well, let's write this question down and look at it in just a moment. It is a good question. Let's finish first the response to Carmen's question, because I certainly cannot add anything to Peter's excellent response, but Ileana can.
I think that he covers everything. I just remember something. I guess that this is one of the points of the books, you know, like he said chapters before that let's change our way of thinking, our way of speaking. Let me challenge you to like have a different like heartbeat, you know. I mean, the things that we are speaking here are like, okay, let's go to the root, to the context of the war. And I mean, that means that we need to forget, try to like have a new vocabulary that will be according to God's word, you know.
Mm. Very good.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, why bother to try to have these new concepts, these new words, and so forth? Why, when you can have what God himself wrote, if you believe that it is God's word? So you're describing the situation of someone who says they believe it's God's word and says they see the difference between God's word and their own conceptions, but still wants to hold on to those conceptions. So to me, that seems like the same case as any time when we confront the Word of God and we find that there's something in us that is different from what God's way is. Mm-hmm. So we have to choose which one we want to hold on to. And I think you can tell partly from Peter's comments the significance, the great significance of that choice, even in very small matters, words and details.
I agree that this should not be a blame game.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose of this is not to play a blame game.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose is to do just what you just said to do.
Right.
That's the purpose. And if what comes out of this is a tenor, is that the right word?
Mm-hmm.
Of, you know, we're playing the blame game, then that's not useful.
Right.
It's also not spiritually acceptable.
Right. So now we're moving to the other question about the intentionality of these choices. And definitely that isn't our purpose to go around blaming different people. And I don't think that's the way we've approached it so far either. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the way the book approaches it. And I don't think that's the way we've approached it in this course. Now, in order to study this material, we do have to point out errors of the past that were made by specific people in specific historical contexts for specific reasons. And sometimes those circumstances may lead us to very strongly believe that or assume that the motives were not good. Now, of course, we can't know anyone's motives, even if they're sitting 5 feet away from us. Only God can really know someone's heart, unless, of course, he reveals it to you. But that doesn't mean that we can't look at the evidence. And this is something, of course, that is done in courtrooms every day to try to determine intent and so forth. And sometimes the circumstantial evidence is very compelling. So if you remember last week, I was suggesting that we had two different types of cases with regard to Jewish Greek. We had, for example, the case of the Testament, which may have been an intentional distortion in some cases, but which we could probably say was usually a misunderstanding because people just didn't really understand what the text was trying to say, and therefore they confused themselves in writing their translations. Now, the information was available to them. There were plenty of people who said that diatheke meant brit, you know, that that was the Jewish-Greek equivalent. So in that, it may have been an intentional distortion even in that case. But we could at least charitably say that some of the people who mistranslated that passage might have been doing so unintentionally. It might just been, have been a misunderstanding. However, on the other hand, I was suggesting that when we come to ekklesia and synagogue, there's no way that you can take that approach. And you don't need to see into someone's heart or mind in order to understand this. It's simply the reality of the text. What is the job of a translator?
To translate.
Okay. Not what does that mean? What is translation?
Not interpretation.
Not interpretation.
Words of another language.
Right. Well, there's always some interpretation in translation, but basically it means to take the words of one language and to express them in a different language. What is necessary in order to be able to do this?
Knowledge
of the meaning of words in both languages. Mm-hmm. Now, the dichotomy between synagogue and ekklesia grew up because of an intentional choice to translate as if these were opposite or opposing concepts. Synagogue and church, synagogue and ekklesia. This is something that no one who has actually read the original text can possibly believe because of the counterexamples that we described. So there's no possible way that ekklesia can mean the Christian church because it obviously does not mean that in Acts 19 when it's used to describe the riotous pagan mob that wanted to kill Shaul and other messianic believers. So there's no way that someone can in good conscience believe that the word ekklesia actually means church that it should be translated that way. The same thing with synagogue. There's no way that a person who has actually read the original text and studied it and is working on it in detail in order to translate it can possibly believe that synagogue refers only to non-believing Jews, Jews who do not believe in the Messiah. Why is this? Well, one of the examples we had from Jacob, where it says to Jewish believers in the Messiah, if a man comes into your synagogue, so in that case, they don't translate it as synagogue. So you see, there's no possible way that these two words could have been misunderstood. And in fact, what we can see is that not only were they not misunderstood, they were understood so well that it became necessary to intentionally mistranslate them in a systematic way in order to preserve the meaning that was desired. So systematically, not randomly, not haphazardly, but systematically, when ekklesia appears in a context that seemed to be good or Christian, it's translated as church. And systematically, when it appears in a different context, it's not translated as church. Systematically, when synagogue appears in a context that appears to be bad or Jewish, it's translated as synagogue. Systematically, when it appears in a different context, it's not translated as synagogue. So this, regardless of whether you can see into people's minds and hearts and so forth, this is not a choice that can be described as simple misunderstanding.
The use of synagogue by the Jewish people, was that self-imposed or was that imposed by the church?
Well, synagogue was simply a word that meant a gathering.
I mean, it's in the, you know, throughout the ages.
How did it come to mean the regular Jewish worship place?
Yes, I mean, I know within the scriptures you're saying that, but why did the Jewish people continue to call that? Or was that something that imposed by the church and the Christians?
Actually, I'm not sure about that. I don't know the history after that point, how it became only a Jewish thing. But probably the explanation is just that Greek culture more or less died out, in at least in the Western world. It persisted, for some centuries in the eastern half, what had been the eastern half of the Roman Empire, but then eventually it collapsed as well there. So my guess is that just partly through this process of translation, the word synagogue came to be associated with the Jewish people because it carries over into Latin and then to the European languages and so forth.
The Jews and never had another word for their gatherings.
Yeah, well, sure. In Hebrew, Hebrew does not say synagogue, by the way.
What do they say?
Beit Knesset, house of gathering. So synagogue is actually just a Greek translation of Beit Knesset, like a place to gather.
Okay. Okay.
So, but so what you're really asking is not about all Jews. It's about why the word synagogue came to be referred to Jewish gatherings in Western languages.
And also when the Jews themselves supported that use of that word.
When they use those languages, yes. When they use those languages. And probably it is related to this process of translation and so forth, that it just carries on. Yeah.
I want to make a, I don't know what the right word is, a suggestion, and I don't know if it's historically accurate or not, but it's just a thought.
Mm-hmm.
We also have to keep in mind that after the second Jewish revolt, the larger Jewish community, that which was not associated with the Messianic believers, made a conscious choice also to divorce itself from the believing community for political, historical, and other reasons. And that in and of itself may have led to a self-characterization on the part of the rabbinical leaders of what was left. And there was very little left. Don't forget that virtually all the Jews were killed in Jerusalem. There were no Jews left in Jerusalem.
Well, a lot were exiled.
Right. They were either killed or exiled, and there were no Jews left in Jerusalem. So as part of the diaspora, the second diaspora, it may well be that in an attempt to self-preserve itself and divorce itself from the Messianic community because of the political historical events that occurred, that maybe they themselves started describing themselves in those terms, which had became popularized shortly thereafter.
Right. Yeah, 2 points from that. A very similar process.
All supposition.
Right. A very similar process to what we've been discussing for Christianity from the 2nd to the 5th centuries, let's say, occurs also in Rabbinic Judaism, which was not established prior to that, and which took many centuries to establish, just as official Christianity took many centuries to be formulated and to be established. So there's kind of a parallel development going on, which leaves Jewish believers in Yeshua excluded from both camps, and actually really outlawed by both camps, and excommunicated and made anathema and so forth by both camps. So there's a struggle going on from both sides. We're primarily dealing, as I mentioned in the first class, with Christian theology in this book. Another book that my father wrote, Rabbi Akiba's Messiah, deals basically with the same thing from the perspective of looking at Rabbinic Judaism and how that view evolved during the same period of time. But we will be looking primarily at Christian issues in this course. A second point, based on what Peter was saying, reminded me, I think the explanation is actually simpler than what I was saying before. The Jewish communities of the diaspora in the time of the Roman Empire were primarily in Greek-speaking areas. And in those areas, the religious assembly and communal assembly of the Jews was called a synagogue because they were Greek-speaking areas. So they grew up as synagogues. And the fact that many Jews were expelled from the land of Israel shifted a lot of the focus of Jewish life to these community centers in different parts of what was or what later became the former Roman Empire. And so probably it's just for that reason that they were called synagogues by everyone in these different cities of the Roman Empire.
Makes sense.
And we're not called ecclesia?
Well, they might be called that too. I can't really explain why one term, came to be dominant without looking in some detail at all of the documents, and the literature and so forth. But it's not essential, I think, for our purposes right now. Yeah. Well, let me pick up just briefly on ecclesia and point out once again that the information that we're talking about was widely available, first of all. It would not have been very difficult to figure this out if people had been willing to go against the overall structure of Christian theology and Christian tradition. Now, I don't mean to make light of what that would have meant. We started off by talking about Copernicus. Copernicus did not allow publication of his book, which said that the earth goes around the sun instead of the sun going around the earth, until he was dying. Why? Because he knew what would happen, and it happened exactly as he thought. So we shouldn't make light of these choices. It would have been an extraordinary person who would have been willing to challenge the system. But nonetheless, it would not have been very difficult to do from just the purely academic perspective, the scholarly perspective, the translation perspective, if you will. The information was available. Well, it depends on the time period as well, what was available and what wasn't. But in general, for many people involved in this process, it has been available. The second point is just to reinforce what I was saying last time, that if Christian translators did what they claimed to do and translated from Koine Greek, the common Greek of the Eastern Roman Empire, it would not be nearly half as bad. And we'd have some pretty decent translations. But they don't do that. And here's just one example. I'm reading again from the Greek lexicon for ekklesia. What is the definition of ekklesia? An assembly of the citizens regularly summoned, the legislative assembly. At Athens, the ordinary assemblies were called curiae, the extraordinary being subkletoi, and so forth. So the ordinary meaning of ekklesia has nothing to do with church, a concept that the Greek world knew nothing about. The ordinary meaning of ekklesia is an assembly that's summoned, that's a group of people that have gathered together. And the literal meaning of the word, as I'm sure you've heard on some occasions, is people that are called out. So they're called out to gather for some purpose. So they assemble. Just as I mentioned that synagoge means people who are led together. So they come together for some purpose. So again, if translators of these texts actually translated from the common Greek of the Roman Empire, we wouldn't have this problem. We might not get the full richness of what's being said. We might miss some things in translation still, but we would not have all of these problems that we're discussing. There are two errors, as I mentioned last time. The first error is mistaking Jewish Greek for Greek, not recognizing that it's a Judeo-Greek that formed already in the times of the Septuagint, and that we can look at it very clearly to see these, what were described by one author as these stereotypical pairs of words, Mashiach, Christos, which is another one, Kahal, Ekklesia, and so forth. So this is something that we can see very clearly linguistically. But they mistook that. They didn't understand that it was actually Jewish Greek, and they thought it was a Greek text. That's the first mistake. But the second mistake I was suggesting is even worse, that instead of then translating as if it's just a Greek language, they translate as if it's a Christian Greek language, which means nothing else than imbuing their own much later, much different concepts into the text, reading things into the text that are not in the text. And that's the problem with it. So keep that in mind as we go through all of the other chapters that deal with translation in some way. I think, though, we should move on to the material for today. That was class 4.5. Now we'll get to class 5. So, chapter 5, office directory. Transliteration creates the illusion of Christian religious offices. Maybe I could get someone just to read the first paragraph of this chapter on page 74.
Entirely new structure of authority and responsibility in the church? No. In Messianic writings, there are some particular words which describe functions, but these were just common Greek words which described the same functions in all spheres of life. The church turned them into ecclesiastical titles by transliterating them instead of translating them. Transliteration keeps the words foreign and outside of normal understanding. It helps create a special religious world. Translating the world would have enabled people to understand it. I had to look up transliteration.
Oh.
And I still don't quite understand his use of the word based on Webster's, which says that transliteration is to write or spell in corresponding characters of another alphabet.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I'll give you an illustration on the board. That's the exact definition. We discussed this a little bit before, but it certainly doesn't help to it doesn't hurt, rather, to review it, because it's something that occurs so much in this text. Oh, you know what? I should have left up one of these words. Here's one.
You could have just kept it there.
All right, we'll just keep this one right here. Well, I could have left the whole sentence, but it's okay. All right, what is this Hebrew word here?
Ish.
How should I transliterate this word? In other words, express the same sounds in characters of a different language.
I-S-H.
That would be one transliteration.
E-E-S-H.
Okay, E-E-S-H. Any other ideas?
E-I-S-H.
E-I-S-H. Why do you say that?
I don't know.
That's right. She just likes it.
Any other ideas?
A-I-S-H?
No, that would well, be H. I'll put it down, but it's probably not a very good one. These aren't the best ones here. But any other ideas?
Yes, it would be the second one, Ish.
Ish, you like this one?
Yeah.
Okay. This is the most common transliteration.
Ish.
That's an ish.
Yes, some people would misunderstand it as ish. Why do you think it's preferable to this one in
because
most contexts?
That's a better phenetic equivalent.
This is a better
equivalent phonetic.
Better equivalent for the letters. Mm-hmm. And that's, you see already there's no perfect transliteration, especially when you're dealing with languages as different as Hebrew
and
English.
So one is better in terms of letter for letter. The other is better phonetically.
Right. This one is better for pronunciation for some people, the way they understand EE. Another transliteration would be something like this. An apostrophe to denote that there's an aleph, which has no equivalent in English. An I to denote the vowel sound here. Mm-hmm. A Y to denote the yud. And SH to denote the shin.
Yeah.
So what we're doing is we're trying to take the different elements of the word and convey them in English so that we have the same, roughly the same phonetic equivalent. Mm-hmm. Now, what is another example of transliteration that we've looked at in previous classes? Maybe it was a name or something.
Where you go from Yaakov to James.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. I cancel it. I withdraw the question. Now, what is the translation of this word?
Man.
That's the transliteration. What's the translation?
Man.
Man. Or male. Male human being. Male,
or
I would
male
guess
spirit?
Although male has a different word, but man is the usual translation. There's no perfect translation either. There could be. We could come up with a list of different translations here as well.
God.
Okay, what about another example?
Oh,
a word or name that we've transliterated and translated.
Yeshua.
Joshua.
Now, there are two different words, Yeshua. Are you referring to the name or the concept?
The name.
The name, okay. The name is derived from the concept, Yeshua, which is salvation. But here we have a name, Yeshua. Let's put transliteration on one side and translation on the other side. What's a good transliteration of this?
Y-E-S-H-U-A.
Any others?
Y-apostrophe-S-H-U-A.
Good. Y-apostrophe-S-H-U-A. Why is that?
Closer to the Hebrew letters?
It might be.
No vowel.
Does anyone know what this symbol is?
Pe.
Fe. Yeah, right.
What is it called?
Oh. Is that cursive?
No, okay.
It's part of the International Phonetic Alphabet.
It is?
Which you will find in Webster's or any other dictionary when you look for the pronunciation of a word. It's called the Shwa. Which is the name of the Hebrew vowel that happens to be here in this word. The Shwa, it's basically what linguists call a half vowel. So it's something between an E and no vowel. Yeah. So that's why it's sometimes represented by an apostrophe. Yeah. So you see that we don't have a perfect transliteration for that either unless we go like this. And what's the problem with this one?
Yeah, it's not an English letter.
Right, it's not English. Mm-hmm. Most people don't understand it. Okay? Now what about a translation?
Salvation.
Probably,
Jesus.
I mean...
To name, Jesus.
Okay, let me just put these up. Salvation... Jesus. Any other?
Joshua.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably the best out of all of these, for at least for certain contexts. But Joshua, of course, is not a translation, really, and neither is Jesus. They're just older transliterations of the same name. This isn't a very good example for translation because it's a name, and usually names are transliterated rather than translated. Because you want to keep the same name. So, for example, when you have the name Yeshayahu in the Hebrew Bible or the Jewish Greek text, it's usually translated not as salvation is of the Lord, but as Isaiah. And the same thing with other names, yeah. Right. It's a little awkward for English speakers. So with names, usually they're transliterated. And that's why the fact that sometimes in, well, not sometimes, frequently, in Christian translations of the Bible, they transliterate different names differently. That's why it becomes important. Why they sometimes say Joshua and other times say Jesus. Why they sometimes say Miriam and other times say Mary. Why they sometimes say Jacob and other times say James. Why? These are the same names. Why are they transliterating them differently in different places?
It's that new thing, the Lord's doing a new thing.
Exactly. It's this whole idea of the opposition between old and new. And so it becomes a very important thing because continually, on a conscious and a subconscious level, whenever anyone of the millions of people who read these texts reads it, they think it's a different thing, and it's not. It's a distortion. But they're constantly getting that impression, which is reinforced in almost every verse, even just because of the names. When really, they should be thinking, when they read about Miriam, the mother of Yeshua, they should be thinking about Miriam, her namesake.
His sister.
And when they read about Yaakov, who's writing a letter to the 12 tribes of Israel, they should be thinking about Yaakov, the father of Israel.
Yeah.
Okay? So it's a distortion. Both just Miriam, in that simple difference of transliteration.
Both Miriam's had some of praises to God.
Right. Yeah. That's very interesting. There's a great point of comparison right there.
What did she say? I did not hear her.
She said both Miriam's had specific songs of praise to God.
Right. Very good. Very good.
So, let's take one more example. I think it's probably clearer now, but let's take one more example that's not a name, just so we can be sure to tell what the, you know, distinction is between translation and transliteration. Any ideas come to mind that we've looked at? Maybe that might be easier.
Synagogue and synagogue.
Okay. Oops. Seal. Let's see. Okay. Think. Boy.
Omega. It's not Omicron, it's Omega.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay. Other than that, it's correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Synagogue. How would we transliterate this? Oh, a few people have joined fraternities.
So S-U-N-A-G-O-G.
A-G. Now here, you know, Greek has two different O's, the small O and the big O, Omega and the Omicron. So here we just do O, or sometimes they put a little hat on it to show that it's the Omega. And then the same thing here, if I'm correct, that it's an Eta instead of an Epsilon. I think so. Again, you have different options, but some people might do that. And so this is a transliteration right here. And then as an example of what happens with transliterations, this gives rise to our English word synagogue, which is nothing but the transliteration anglicized a little bit, so that it's easier for English speakers to pronounce. Let me give you another example. Who can read this word?
Moskva,
that's right. Moskva. How would you transliterate this into English?
Moscow.
M-O-S-C-O-W. Moscow.
M-O-S-K-O-V-A. Moskva. But that's not very easy for English speakers to say, so it becomes Moscow.
Moscow.
Later with a W.
And then we pronounce it Moscow.
Actually, the W probably.
Because we like cows.
So, right. So Moscow is not a new name or even a translation. It's just the anglicized transliteration. Mm-hmm. Just as, you know, Joshua is not a translation. It's just an anglicized transliteration from Latin, which is a transliteration from Greek, which is a transliteration from Hebrew. Okay?
Sounds like that telephone game.
Now, that's the transliteration. What would the translation be for this word?
Gathering.
Gathering, okay.
Okay.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
or something else. Again, there's no perfect transliteration or translation. Because words in one language are not the same as words in another language.
Context, context, context.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to make your choices. But one thing that you shouldn't do when you translate words is to say, well, I think that what the text is saying is this. And if I translate it the way that one would naturally translate the text, it gives a different meaning. So I'm going to translate the text differently in accordance with what I think it means. That's a problem. And by the way, this is not a problem that's confined to translation. It's a problem that comes up in different forms in every sphere of life.
Say that last word again. It's a form that what?
It's a problem that comes up in some form in every sphere of life.
Oh, okay.
Whether what type of a choice you make in interpreting any situation that you have in front of you. Do you interpret the situation as it is, or do you interpret it as you think it should be, or as you want it to be? So, that's transliteration and translation. Any questions before I leave the board? Okay. Now, it's good that we reviewed that, because it's actually very important for understanding this chapter, as you can see from the subtitle. Transliteration creates the illusion of Christian religious offices. So the argument is being made, first of all, that Christian religious offices are something that are not actually from the text, that, in other words, they represent an illusion. All of these different words like and positions like presbyters and elders and deacons and all of these sorts of things that seem like special positions in a special world, that's actually an illusion. And then the second part of the argument is that this illusion is created specifically by transliteration instead of translation of certain words. So again, the argument is that we can discover how this arose and why it arose. And we'll look at that in a moment. Let me just draw attention to a couple things in that first paragraph that Ellen read. Right now we're just in chapter 5, but you could actually find in that translation, if you like, any of the verses that we're going to be dealing with. For example, Ephesians 4:11, and then you'll have a chance later to read it out. So, isn't there an entirely new structure of authority and responsibility in the church? In other words, picking up on the chapter about the church itself, that there is no church, how do you respond to the idea that, look, we do have a different world? You know, we have elders and presbyters and deacons and who knows what else.
Too.
Okay.
This is nothing new.
Okay. Right. I'm just posing the question.
Okay.
But yeah, that's part of the response, absolutely, that's going to be presented. But this is a conceivable objection, in other words, to the idea that there's no church. Well, look, we do have a different world. We do have different concepts. We do have different understandings and functions and positions. And many people would look at Ephesians 4:11, which we'll get to as part of that.